And André Malraux, in writing his memoirs, or anti-memoirs as he called them, speculated that the truth about a man is first of all what he hides, but he differentiated between what a man hides and what he ignores in himself. The two are not the same. Stendhal wrote one book after another about himself in an effort to understand who and what he was, but the search for the truth eluded him. "What manner of man am I?" he finally asked, and admitted, "In truth, I haven't the faintest idea." There are other problems in writing memoirs. They have to do with the past and with time. "The past is never dead," wrote Faulkner. "It's not even past. You cannot ruminate about the past and write about it without transforming it. Immediately, the imagination enters into play until it is impossible to separate memory from imagination. Or to sort out time. Einstein, for whom the conception of time was so important in his theory of relativity and in mathematics and physics generally, thought it was impossible to sort it out. "The separation between past, present, and future," he said, "has only the meaning of an illusion, albeit a tenacious one." Rousseau, whose Confessions is probably the greatest and the most self-searing of all the autobiographies, thought first of writing simply a portrait of himself. He spent 12 years preparing to write it, assembling notes and mulling over notebooks, letters, and other material. In the end, he rejected the idea of doing a portrait, not only because he thought it would be static, but because it would present a final judgment of himself made late in life. Time would play its tricks. Instead, he decided to relate all that has happened to me, all that I've done, all that I've thought, all that I've felt. I cannot be wrong about what I've felt. But he deceives himself. Like every other who writes of his life, he transforms it by the writing. "That is why," wrote Marcel Raymond, the editor of the Pléiade French edition of Confessions, "the history of his soul, which he promised us, becomes, without his knowing it, the legend or the myth of his soul." An observation or two about my own view of life as a background to these memoirs. Only rarely have I paused amid the trivia of living which make up so much of our existence, and out of which come the setbacks, the triumphs, the sorrows, and the rare moments of happiness, to consider how puny and unimportant we all are. How puny, in fact, is our planet. Even the solar system, of which the Earth is a negligible part, is but a dot in the infinite space of the universe. The limited space and time that we can comprehend are nothing in the incalculable extent and age of inorganic nature. Who can say, then, that the purpose of the universe, if it has a purpose, has been to create man? Who can even say that there are not billions of other planets on which there is some kind of human life, perhaps much further advanced than ours, or at least more sane, meaningful, and peaceful? Every person's life is of importance to himself, of course. It is the only one he has and knows. But in the universe of infinite space and time, it is insignificant. "Qu'est-ce qu'un homme dans l'infini?" asked Pascal. Nothing. Perhaps Karl Becker, the historian and one of the most civilized men I ever knew, grasped best our piddling place in the infinite. "Man," he wrote, "is but a foundling in the cosmos, abandoned by the forces that created him. Unparented, unassisted, and undirected by omniscient or benevolent authority, he must fend for himself, and with the aid of his own limited intelligence find his way about in an indifferent universe." And in a rather savage world. The longer I lived and the more I observed, the clearer it became to me that man had progressed very little beyond his earlier savage state. After 20 million years or so of human life on this earth, the lot of most men and women is, as Hobbes said, nasty, brutish, and short. Civilization is a thin veneer. It is so easily and continually eroded or cracked, leaving human beings exposed for what they are, savages.